Ladies and gentlemen, could I please have your attention quickly just before we begin? Simply for the purposes of recording, if you do have a question, please do raise your hand and I'll make sure that you have your mic. And when you do, if you could just hold it really close, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much for your time.
Let's start.
Thank you. Oh, is it working? Okay, it's Louisa Hector from Exane. So a couple of questions on Tecentriq first. So you presented the OAK data at ESMO, so that was the phase 3 second-line lung study. And I noticed in the ESMO slides that this was a readout on about 75% of the patients, and that was a pre-specified endpoint. So I'm just wondering if any of your phase 3 IO chemo combo studies have a similar readout earlier on a smaller subgroup of patients, and whether that could bring your timelines forward at all. So that's Tecentriq. And then... I'd like to touch on Esbriet as well, just because it looked a little bit weak. You're talking about needing to do the patient education. So was there anything specific in the fourth quarter that led to that weakness? Thanks.
Terrific. Thanks, Louisa. And, oh, wow, this is loud. On the OAK, and Carl, you can add here, clearly. But I think, you know, the issue is all of these trials are event-driven, so they need to get to a statistical significance to read out, and then the DSMB will alert us, and that's how we kind of were able to know to bring OAK in actually into the review timeline, because we saw how the events were kind of proceeding. So I think in general that concept applies across our portfolio, which is why we. You know, I mean, even for the Empower 150, I mean, you know, we're not sure if it'll be quarter three or quarter four this year. It'll be completely due to the events. I can assure you that we won't try to, go overboard when we get significance that we think is there. We'll do the readout and then and let the trial carry on to the endpoints as we have with other trials. Not to my knowledge. Is there anything unique about OAK in Europe?
There was, because it was completely overpowered. That was the uniqueness of the trial. It was 1,200 patients,
exactly.
And we already could have had statistical significance with much less patients. But this is how you learn it. Yeah. So you will get a full update of OAK at ESCO. The rest of the patients.
Yeah.
But it will not change the result of the filing and of the approval. I mean, you will just have more patients in.
And then on Esbriet, no, I don't think, I mean, there is a bit of lumpiness quarter to quarter with Esbriet. I've seen that over the course of this year. I don't think there was anything extraordinary in the fourth quarter that I've seen in my review with the affiliates that was a different trend or a new trend. I think the key is that we really need now, because we have quite a penetration into the moderate patient segment. I mean, it's pretty good. We need to now get into this mild patient, and we're working with a physician audience that is not used to having anything to treat these patients, and still I think, particularly in the mild patient segments, maybe have an over concern about potential tolerability, at least in our experience, and therefore getting patients more involved in this decision making, patients who. No, this is an ever degrading, debilitating disease. To get more involved in their care, you know, this is not oncology, right? So this is not the same type of readily available information and action-oriented patients. I think we really, the age group of these patients and their sophistication is something I think we have to work on. What we're really happy with is that the IPF Association. And physicians, particularly the leading physicians, are really behind us on this patient education program. So we're hoping that that's the thing that can tilt the needle, and we just have to keep focused on that.
Yes, Richard Parkes from Deutsche Bank. Got a few questions on emicizumab. Firstly, I'm just interested in your... obviously, we're not going to see the data till ISTH, but I'm just wondering how... that impacts your confidence about emicizumab's potential competitiveness in the non-inhibitor setting. Obviously, the drug's activity or efficacy should be no reason why it should be different between inhibitors and the non-inhibitor setting. but obviously the efficacy hurdle for being competitive with first-line haemophilia therapy is much higher hurdle than in the inhibitor setting. So can you give us some sense about how confident you are that the drug will be competitive in that setting, or do you think the convenience of the subcut dosing would be enough in itself, even if maybe you didn't meet quite that high hurdle? So that's the first question. Then the second question, just again, emicizumab in the non-inhibitor setting, I'm just wondering what additional safety data you'll need in addition to the headline readout at the end of this year. I'm assuming you'll need longer-term safety data. And then the third one, also emicizumab, just wondering how much experience you have with treating breakthrough bleeds with Nova 7. I mean, do you have enough experience there to give you confidence that you won't have the same adverse event profile?
And the last one is in the inhibitor population, you mean? Yeah, of course. Thanks, Richard. So I guess a couple of things. The non-inhibitor phase 3 trial is getting going now. We obviously had the some of the patients in an extension study that we're converting over now to the non-inhibitor. I think the best evidence we have so far in the non-inhibitor still comes from the phase 1b and the phase 1b extension, where we saw in the non-inhibitor population still a very significant reduction in bleeds. In some patients, we went up with the dose a bit, but in all cases, we saw a significant reduction in bleed compared to what I would call historical standards there. So, our non-inhibitor expectation is, and it all has to be proven out in the study later this year that it will read out, is that, yes, we'll have a more efficacious drug than the alternative, that because of the dosing and the convenience, that we can actually also convert more and more of the market to the prophylactic segment, because we know in the non-inhibitor population segment, for convenience reasons, but also to a certain extent for longer-term efficacy reasons, that about half the market is only converted to prophylaxis. So there's significant, I think, potential to shift the market to prophylaxis with a more efficacious, convenient treatment that would actually position itself for prophylaxis. But all that has to be proved in the inhibitor. All we can do is continue to monitor our phase 1 extension and do the non-inhibitor trial and see how it reads out. But our confidence there is certainly not low. And to the second point you made around the safety, again, we're following these patients in the phase 1 now for, gosh, how long? Some of those patients are going out
2 to 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, from the initial Japanese trial. Now, it's a small number of patients, but we're not seeing anything in the safety follow-up of those patients, which are both inhibitor and non-inhibitor, that would put us at concern or in any way of new safety signals at all. I think the safety signals that we've seen also in the Haven 1 trial and in the phase 1b are very consistent with the mechanism of this product in this disease state and in this patient setting. So, again, all this has to be demonstrated out through more trials, but there's no reason to suggest that we won't have sufficient safety data and efficacy data and it's always a safety risk benefit profile to seek regulatory approval based upon, in fact, that's our full expectation, based upon a positive readout now of Haven 3. So that's all good. And we haven't seen any other inability to control bleeds with bypassing agents in the inhibitor trial, the ongoing extension, when bypassing agents are used according to label and according to our revised protocol. So again, it's a certain segment of patients, but we're very encouraged. Right. Did you have the final one was experience with inhibitors? Sorry.
What I wanted to add to what Dan said is what Dan mentioned in the presentation. You have basically a on-demand treatment versus prophylactics. So basically this was the endpoint. And we had a statistical significant reduction, an impressive one. But what we also did is in the secondary endpoint, we compared prophylaxis versus prophylaxis. So basically, we also looked if in the same patient, if you want to have horizontally, if there is, if you can better control the patients. And also here we saw a remarkable reduction in the control of the disease. So that means two things. First of all, that you have a high medical need in those patients, because otherwise you don't show a meaningful reduction, a substantial one. And the second is that obviously we have a solution which does exactly that, what the drug should do, horizontally and vertically for the patients are concerned. That's maybe what also helps. So it's not for nothing. There is a medical need which we can serve in both areas.
There was somebody in the back that had a question. Should we give a little equity to the back of the room?
Marriott, I mean, it's Prime Avenue. Two questions, please. The first one is on your European Herceptin business. Can you just give us a rough feel for what percent of that in both volume and value terms is Herceptin subcutaneous, or what the price is for a Herceptin subcutaneous versus the infusion, and maybe a rough feel for the sort of cost savings that the centers are actually generating with the SC version in the adjuvant setting? I'm just really trying to get a feel for, in the event that affinity is negative, how much of a discount would a biosimilar need to offer to Herceptin in order to basically be competitive in that space that has converted over to Herceptin SC. And then my second question is just on the cost of goods and pharma. I mean, what should we model for period costs as a percentage of sales going forward? Because I think we've been discussing for quite a number of years that there are additional costs from the investment into new manufacturing plants for monoclonals, and I was just wondering, where we're actually really at in that cycle, and at what point, there will be a leveling off or sort of a decline in that incremental cost. Thank you.
Thanks, Marianne. So, I mean, a lot of subtleties around your first question. I would say, generally we're launched in most European markets, with the exception of Germany. Germany has a incentive system, by the way, not too dissimilar from the United States, where it's physicians are paid on infusions. So that's rather unfortunate for the overall healthcare system, but it is the way it is. It's it doesn't encourage cost savings. But in the other countries where we're launched, as I said in the presentation, I mean, we have as high as 70 to 75% share in some of the Nordic countries. And our average across the countries where we're launched in Europe is probably more around 40 to 50% with Herceptin.
Approaching 50 now.
Approaching 50% with Herceptin. Now, I mean, it's really hard to answer your questions around cost savings. It depends very much, country to country. But what many of the institutions have done is they've switched the entirety of their Herceptin business, sometimes the entirety of their MabThera business, to sub-Q to free up infusion chair time. So oftentimes it's a physical structure limitation that they have at their institutions to be able to get enough patients through infusion chairs. And it's each hospital can put a number on that, but I can't put a number on it from the standpoint of the entirety of Europe. So I think there are barriers to switching back to IV. I would say, they're not impenetrable barriers. In other words, at a certain price, I'm quite sure that healthcare systems would switch back. But they are going to take, those that have made the switch are going to take into account, the soft costs. I mean, what about more infusion chairs? What about the time period it takes for patients to be in a chair? I would love to say that Europe is going to be concerned about the convenience for patients, but probably not, even though we know from a patient convenience standpoint this is a huge, huge benefit. But just from a healthcare system benefit perspective, I think this is a serious impediment. And I can't answer your question yet because we're going into the big unknown here about, what price point do you switch back? But clearly, it provides an additional barrier for biosimilars to get through. And then,
The SE and the infusion are priced the same, correct?
Oh, yes,
All right.
Yes, that is. In fact, they're basically parity pricing everywhere that we have them in the markets. Maybe in one or two markets, in fact, sub-Q might be 5% less to encourage the switching. But we haven't gone for a premium pricing strategy with sub-Q because of the fact that we wanted to convert the market quickly. And in the pharma, the cost of goods line. So, I mean, yes, we've been talking about the capital investment for a couple of years, and it's a very significant capital investment, both in the United States and in Europe. But what's happening dynamically right now is that the additional capacity expansion is really just beginning to come in line. And I'll just use our biggest example, our one example, which is Vacaville, which is just north of California. That is by far the world's largest biological manufacturing capacity in the world, multiple 12K tanks, and we've doubled the capacity by opening up so-called CCP2. So that's open up now. It's got pilot runs running. But in order to get that up to full capacity, that's going to take a couple of years. I mean, just to put that into concept, you have to do tech transfers into that part of the center, and to fully utilize that capacity is not a 6-month thing. It's a couple of years thing. So we benefited this year. You saw the COGS in the detailed financial reports would have increased by around 11% this year. If it weren't for the benefit from the PDL out royalties. I don't expect that it's going to moderate a little bit next year, but we're going to continue to see a high COGS line in the P&L next year, and we'll have less of a benefit from the PDL royalty next year. So you'll definitely see the cost of sales line next year, I can assure you, being higher than 1% at the end of next year. But then as we start to go into 2018, 2019, we get tech transfers into the facility. We use that and the other facilities we've expanded up to capacity that we're trying to get to, which is around 80%. By the way, we've been running at close to 100%, which is not healthy and not good in terms of supply to the market. That could have an impact on sales and penetration. So I think getting to an 80% capacity allows us to amortize those facilities better. And I think that starts to happen. We start to bend the curve again in the 18-19 timeframe. Of course, we're working on productivity initiatives that allow us to even offset some of this decreased capacity utilization. So we'll be able to offset some of that. It's not just a pure, well, we have more capacity and there's nothing we can do about cost. We have lots of programs going on across our manufacturing network to try to offset that as much as possible. But the true offset, I think, will be more midterm than short term.
Sam?
Thanks very much. It's Sam Fazeli from Bloomberg Intelligence. I have four easy questions.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, Sam.
What is the key reason that people use Tecentriq in lung for the indication? Is it lack of testing or is it because of the dosing? The next one is CTLA-4. You've obviously never got into it. It's not on your pipeline list. Can you remind us what drove that decision, what continues to drive that decision? Is it commercial?
CTLA-4?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it because they've got 60, 70 trials ongoing, et cetera? And then what are the key combinations that you're excited about in 2017? And lastly, what would the crossover be in 150 in the chemo combo Avastin? What would patients, when they progress, go on to?
Good. Okay. Yeah, four easy questions. Let's start with the key reason for Tecentriq uptake in the second line. Again, I'm going to give you more clarity on this the first quarter call and the second quarter call. But clearly, I mean, we know for a fact, and that was proven actually before we ever got into second line lung, that when you have an all-comers label, you have a greater uptake than when you have a diagnostically enriched label. I mean, the concept of, and I'm not suggesting, and we don't have the data yet, that patients aren't being tested, but our qualitative intelligence is that, particularly in the second line setting, testing is not rampant. It's not everywhere. So I think there's probably a minority of patients that are being tested. So ease of use, second line lung cancer setting, these are really sick patients that are going to progress quickly. You want to get them on a therapy quickly. You don't necessarily want to wait for a test result, but beyond that, you see the all-comers benefit and you move with it. So I think clearly, now I'm doing a little bit of guessing, but the fact that not just PD-L1 status, but also because of the data we saw in survival between smokers, non-smokers, all the different subcategories, we showed really strong efficacy parameters. It's an easy-to-use drug from an efficacy standpoint for physicians in the second-line setting. They don't have to really consider triaging or segmenting the patients. The we shouldn't underestimate the every 3 week as well. I mean, we saw that play out between the other two entrants into this market as well. And I think that's also a significant advantage. I mean, if I'm a patient and, you know, my doctor asked me whether I want to come back every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks, and I'm already having a pretty miserable quality of life and I'm trying to extend that as much as possible, boy, I'll tell you which one I would take. So I think that is also a real benefit in that segment. But we'll do more market research and we'll give you a bit more as we get more experience. So why not CTLA-4? I think, you know, there are both scientific reasons and there are practical reasons. I mean, scientifically, we studied CTLA-4 in the preclinical setting, and early on, we decided that we thought that there were even more attractive targets to go after in terms of combinations with PD-L1. Now, you know, history still has to play out, so we'll figure that out. But we don't feel like we're missing something by not having CTLA-4 because we have other targets and mechanisms that we've gone after that we think either replicate CTLA-4 or potentially have co-stimulatory effects, you know, either on killer or regulatory T cells. So there's a variety of different approaches we have. All have to be determined by the readouts that we'll see in 17 and 18. But I think, you know, we're okay where we are right now with our decision on CTLA-4. And you also have to, and the practical reason is you have to choose where to play. You have to choose where to win. And I think, you know, we've chosen chemo combos. We've chosen another, you know, we've chosen about every other target in cancer immunotherapy to test. And I think we'll be well informed by the end of this year which of those bets were good ones, which were bad ones, which we're going to continue. I mean, there will be bad ones in there as well, and we'll progress ahead. What key combos are we most excited about? I don't know. I would say beyond the combo, you know, we like the early stuff we're seeing on the bispecific antibodies. You know, we have a couple of programs, two programs in our PRED organizations, two in GRED. The PRED are a little more advanced. The solid tumors are a little more advanced than the hematologics with the CD20 backbone. We hope we might be able to show some data at ASCO. There's a chance to get it at ASCO on the CEA CD3 in solid tumors. We still like what we're more than looking for. Okay, and mono and combo. That's right. It's mono and combo with PD-L1. What else do you like, Carl? It's hard to pick our favorite children. You like
CSF1R
still?
No, I would say for the CSF1R, you have a complete new platform, which potentially could replace what you currently have. And this drug we have in the clinic since 2014. So it's in the clinic now since more than 2.5 years. We have seen the patients. It's open label for us, so we know what the drug can do. And so that is, let's say, something where you can have more confidence because you know what you're talking about. Huh? The CSF1R most likely will come at ASCO now. I simply haven't seen the data, so I don't know if it is good on that. But we'll see what it brings. So the first data which we had seen in monotherapy actually looked extremely encouraging, but it needs to be seen now how it is in combination. And this works more on the tumor environment, so maybe that is also something. Then we have the CD40 combination data, most likely at ASCO. So there is a series of new things which are coming. But I would say if you have to grade it in terms of, let's say, priorities, I would say the T-cell bispecifics are clearly on top of the list at the moment.
So, and the final question on the crossover, I mean, crossover can always occur in trials. As you know, with the EMPOWER 150, we've got the chemo versus the chemo plus the Tecentriq with and without Avastin. So I guess it would depend. I mean, Carl tells me, you know, maybe just to push the issue a little bit, that our statisticians think there's a relatively good chance that PFS and OS could read out in EMPOWER 50 at the same time. So we may not have a crossover issue. I'll just put it out on the table. Yeah. But if it doesn't, they've also factored in, so how could it work out? I mean, depending on the PFS readouts, you could have, you know, you could potentially have, you know, patients, you know, crossing over to the most effective PFS arm. I mean, that's always the way it potentially works.
I mean, crossover is, if you look at the historical data, I mean, we haven't allowed crossover per protocol. but we have factored in crossover in reality, because I mean you have to assume that there will be crossover if you want or if you don't want, and then you actually can balance by two things: first of all, where you do the trial, and second of all, let's say with the amount of patients you include into the trial. So basically, you can embed a certain crossover in the trial readout. And this we have done. It doesn't mean that if you allow crossover that you don't have an overall survival benefit, because if you look at the Merck data monotherapy, they allowed crossover and had an overall survival benefit. So it doesn't mean that if you have crossover, if you don't, so it doesn't have crossover, that you necessarily have an OS or don't have an OS. It really depends on the strength of your compound. And it depends on the number of patients you have included in the trial in order to secure a positive readout.
And we literally just have 2 minutes left to end the session. Thank you.
Mark Becker from Fidelity. So I think all the IO players and even doctors are saying OS is probably a better marker of understanding what's going on than PFS, just as a statement. So if I don't want you to think about conjecturing that you're the FDA, but you have to on this question. The FDA is going to receive MYSTIC PFS data, and they're going to receive your OS data a few months later, and we don't know where the cutoffs are in terms of the buckets of expression in terms of these two trials. How does the FDA make such a decision? Is it first come, first serve, or is it going to be a comprehensive view, do you think, of waiting to see these two trials together?
No, I mean, first of all, I agree with you on OS versus PFS. But I think as it relates to MYSTIC and Empower 150, I mean, they're not necessarily, it's not one or the other. I mean, I guess both could potentially read out positive in different patient segments. If you ask me, I think it's more likely that, and I could be wrong on this, but the chemo combo has a broader patient segment, but we'll see. But even if it's the same patient segment, the FDA isn't concerned. I mean, they want multiple options for physicians and
I think the point more is it's PFS versus OS.
But you ultimately may have overall survival benefit in MYSTIC as well. I mean, nobody knows.
That's right.
The question is, what is the FDA allowing for filing? And frankly, we have no answer on this one, because I guess it will depend on a case-by-case decision what they take. It will depend, I guess, on the strength of the data, of the PFS data. It will it will base on the fact that if you have an OS trend or if there is absolutely nothing, I would say most likely they will look at the totality. And
trial ongoing
exactly,
that's going to read out shortly,
things.
Such as they feel comfortable with an accelerated approval. So I think all those things play out.
It's
right?
Difficult to answer your question.
I wish I had a crystal ball, but just as we're smarter now than we were a year ago, I know we're going to be smarter at the end of 2017 too. But it'll be interesting to see how they process, which I have every reason to believe they'll process it well, the Keytruda data on a PFS secondary.
With 120 patients, 60 patients in the active arm, in the chemo arm, and still, we had seen formidable PFS benefit in that trial with a hazard ratio of 0.5. I would say Merck is now trying to prove the case in a phase 3, and I would say then you have a complete picture of chemo combo. It's encouraging for us, because we are thinking along the long lines, so this is basically a confirmation of what we have always said. But I would say you need clearly also in this case phase 3 and a solid clinical development program. Just I would say 120 patients only to judge on.
Apologies,
and
gentlemen.
This landscape is going to change. I'll just one more statement. I mean, I think to your point, I think what you're inferring, Mark. I mean, once you have multiple OS approved therapies in frontline lung, I mean, FDA may look at this very differently for follow-on agents.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
I'm not so sure they would have a Keytruda view if you have a chemo combo OS and a PD-L1 CTLA-4. Yeah. So we can't. The regulators aren't going to stay static here as well, which is I think to Andrew's question. I mean, how do you get flexibility, agility in your organization to keep changing and to keep moving? I mean, and how do you build flexibility into your trial programs such that you can have multiple shots on goal? I guess this is the formal end. If people want to switch
sessions. If you want to stay in the pharma session, please stay on. Huh? You don't have to leave. and you still get the red wine later on if you stay or if you leave.
The wine is for whether you stay?
The wine is not for you because you have to leave to the
airport. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.